There's certainly been movement in American race relations in recent years. Lots of white people are posting Black Lives Matter signs on their lawns, and the huge statue of Robert E. Lee no longer looms over Monument Avenue in Richmond, Virginia, the former capital of the Confederacy. Those are symbols. Actual change in black-white race relations is much less easy to achieve. Our guest this hour knows and has been paying attention for a long time. Randall Kennedy is out with a big book of essays, Say It Loud, on race, law, history, and culture. Randall Kennedy is a professor at Harvard Law School and has been for many years. He teaches courses on contracts, criminal law, and the regulation of race relations. Randall Kennedy is the author of six previous books, including Race, Crime, and the Law. Randall Kennedy, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks so much for having me on.
It's a pleasure. And there's a great phrase in the beginning of the book. In the essays that follow, I luxuriate in the messiness. The messiness of what?
Well, the messiness of the race line in American life. It's a large subject, and it's a complicated subject, and it's a paradoxical subject. It has many sides. It's a subject that's filled with much tension, so that's why it's messy.
Yeah. In fact, you mentioned that there are three beliefs in constant tension throughout the essays. First, that racism continues to be a major force in America. Second, that there is much to be inspired by in the African-American journey from slavery to freedom. And third, that social relations are complex and messy. To the first belief, that racism continues to be a major force in America, how much for you did the rise of Donald Trump confirm that belief?
Well, it was hugely important for me. It was a terrible disappointment. And it has caused me to revise things that I have said and written in the past. So just not so long ago, I wrote that no politician with national ambitions would say and do things that could reasonably be viewed as just out-and-out racist. Well, clearly I was wrong. And the election of Donald Trump, and maybe even more, the fact that with the election just passed, he lost, but he did receive a lot of support. I mean, it was a close race. That I find just terribly troubling, given his actions, given his statements throughout his presidency. So that has had a very big effect on my thinking.
And that brings us into the first essay called Shall We Overcome? Optimism and Pessimism in African-American Racial Thought. But you mention a lot of other names in here, too, including Alexis de Tocqueville. Was he one of many who thought we'd never have racial harmony?
Yes, Alexis de Tocqueville was thoroughly pessimistic. In fact, there's no one who has been more pessimistic than Alexis de Tocqueville. In his great book, Democracy in America, he has a chapter called The Three Races in America. He's talking about Native Americans, blacks, and whites. And he said that in his belief was that these groups would never be able to share this country on an equal basis as neighbors. He thought that racial inequality was really baked into America. With respect to blacks and whites, his basic belief was that everyone would always know that blacks in America had been enslaved. And remember, he's writing in the early 1830s.
Yeah.
And he says, even after slavery is abolished, everyone will know that the blacks were once enslaved. And his belief was that the confluence of racial difference and slavery had forever poisoned the well. So he was quite pessimistic, as were other people who will certainly be familiar to our listeners. Thomas Jefferson was very pessimistic. In Notes on the State of Virginia, he took the position that blacks and whites would never be able to share the country as equals. And he, too, was very attentive to slavery. He basically said that blacks would always remember the enslavement of their forebears, and whites would have this memory, too, and that this would forever, the memory of it would forever alienate these two groups. Abraham Lincoln was thoroughly pessimistic. That's why Lincoln, in his adult years, maintained a deep interest in colonization, believing that even after the abolition of slavery, blacks and whites simply would not be able to get along on a equal basis in America. So my essay mainly talks about black thinkers with respect to this question, but I thought it important to also talk about, what about white thinkers who have faced this issue?
Well, and I want to ask about W.E.B. Du Bois, because he was an optimist at first, and I want to warn you, we're about a minute away from a break here. How and where did his story end?
Well, his story ended with him being a pessimist. I mean, after all, he left the United States. He renounced his citizenship. He joined the Communist Party in order to basically manifest his disgust with America. So he ended really as a pessimist. Previous to then, he had occupied many different positions.
Dr. Kennedy, I want to come back to the optimism and pessimism in African-American racial thought essay at the beginning of the book. It really sets the tone for a lot of what follows. And I don't want to just leave it off with the pessimist, because there were people who did change from the other direction. They became optimists. Frederick Douglass, for example, said he didn't think much of the American Constitution before the Civil War, but he felt differently afterward.
Yeah, Frederick Douglass, absolutely remarkable figure. You're absolutely right. Early in his career as an abolitionist, he was a Garrisonian abolitionist who believed that the Constitution of the United States was totally illegitimate. He had a thoroughly he was disgusted with the United States, but he changed over time and became a racial optimist. Even before the abolition of slavery, he was asked, "Well, do you see a time when there will be racial equality in the United States?" And he said, yes. So actually, in the 19th century, if I had to pick the most eloquent racial optimist, it would be Frederick Douglass. He was also the most eloquent racial pessimist, but like I said, he became an optimist. There were others, of course, in the optimistic tradition. In the 20th century, the most eloquent would probably be Martin Luther King Jr. I mean, think of his great speech, "I Have a Dream," August 1963. And then think 5 years later, right before he's killed, he talks about glimpsing the racial promised land. He's been to the mountaintop, and he might not get to the promised land with us, but he has seen it. So King was an optimist. In the 21st century, the most consequential racial optimist would be Barack Obama. Yes, we can. Mm-hmm. And so the optimistic tradition is an interesting tradition and has very distinguished people in it. Among the pessimistic tradition is actually, I think, the more interesting. It has a wider range. I mentioned before Alexis de Tocqueville, Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln. But among the pessimists would also be Marcus Garvey, would also be Elijah Muhammad of the Nation of Islam. So, both traditions are part of our culture, and both of them tap into things, and both of them have something to say. They are both glimpsing important parts of American history. Racism runs deep, but anti-racism runs deep too. People shouldn't forget that.
I suppose this is why you tell us in this essay you have abandoned much of your faith in optimism, but not all of it. So it's still hanging in there.
I am. Again, you know, I am shaken. I have to say that. I am not as confident as I used to be. The past few years, and, you know, including the present moment. I mean, we are in a very perilous moment, and so I'm shaken, but I still put myself in the optimistic camp overall, I guess in part because, you know, in my lifetime, I have seen substantial change. I was born in 1954. I was born in Columbia, South Carolina, and I saw the end of Jim Crow, and my parents suffered under Jim Crow. My parents were refugees from the Jim Crow South. But in my lifetime, I have seen considerable change. For 8 years in my life, the president of the United States was a black man. As I speak right now, the vice president of the United States is a person who identifies as a black American. So, as I speak right now, the head of the Department of Defense is a black American. So, again, we have to be, we can't be sentimental. There are perils. We are menaced on every side. There is racism. There is racial resentment, very deep, very powerful. But at the same time, there has been change, and there are forces that are strongly opposed to racial oppression, and their voices are heard too, and they've had an opportunity to shape our country as well.
Randall Kennedy is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange from Harvard Law School, the author of a book of essays called Say It Loud on Race, Law, History, and Culture. As you mentioned perils, this brings us into the second essay about Derek Bell and me, and I just had a chance to read Jelani Cobb's profile in the latest New Yorker. Derek Bell, known for many things, but getting connected most lately with critical race theory.
Yes. Well, Derek Bell would be an important voice in the 20th century for racial pessimism. I mean, his signature writing was writing that propounded his notion of the permanence of white racism. I mean, he basically believed that no, we shall not overcome. He basically believed that It was important to engage in struggle. He was a fervent activist, and he believed in struggling against racism. But he believed that racism was really, white supremacy was baked into America, and that it would continue essentially to be a white supremacist regime. Now, he was my colleague. He was my friend. He was also my ideological adversary. I think at certain points he thought that I was, basically sentimental. He thought that I didn't view the United States critically enough. And I wanted in this essay to give a full airing out of our disputes, but also I wanted to indicate how much I respected him, including respecting him enough to disagree with him. I think, unfortunately, that many of the people who actually embrace Derek Bell and who laud him, I think sell him short because, it's all about lauding him. It's all about agreeing. It's all about applause. But, people who write, people who think hard about things, they want their thinking to be taken seriously. And nobody writes something that's perfect. I mean, you know, the most distinguished intellectuals in the history of the world are people who, in, you know, create and engender debate. And one of the things I wanted to show was that, you know, Derek Bell's writing, certainly there's much good about it, but it's certainly, you know, there's certain things that he says that are highly debatable. And that was one of the things that I really wanted to bring out in my essay, Derek Bell and Me.
One of his major points, though, was that, I mean, you could count gains, at least that there were supposed to be, with, you know, Brown versus Board of Education, with the passage of the 64 Civil Rights Act, with the passage of the 65 Voting Rights Act, but that the way he saw it, as I understand, was that the system always found a way to adapt. And is the Supreme Court in recent years proving his point?
I don't think it proves his point, but it certainly substantiates, you know, a portion of what he says, and a portion of what he says is absolutely true. It's absolutely true that the people who have fought to keep America a white man's country have shown tremendous resiliency, have shown tremendous flexibility, have shown a tremendous ability to retreat when necessary, and then recoup. So you had people who were all for segregation. And then when it became untenable for them to defend segregation anymore, then they adopted a new slogan. So some of the same people who were for segregation then embraced, you know, a colorblind constitution. They embraced a colorblind constitution not because they had, you know, had a change of heart and wanted a multiracial democracy. No, they embrace a colorblind constitution in order to attack things like affirmative action. They showed themselves to be quite adept at being strategic and, you know, using whatever tools were at hand to attack whatever they perceived to be a progressive racial thought. Similarly, today, you have people who attack critical race theory. What do they use to attack critical race theory? They use Martin Luther King to attack critical race theory. Now, previously, they were all against Martin Luther King Jr. They would have attacked Martin Luther King Jr. in, let's say, 1965. They don't think that it's, you know, they don't think that it's tenable to do that anymore, so they embrace Martin Luther King Jr.'s rhetoric to do what? To attack people who they now view as racial progressives. So, again, you know, there's much of what Derek Bell had to say that was quite useful, and I try to point that out in my essay. Yet, you know, there's still things that I think are certainly debatable, or frankly, parts of his view that ought to be criticized, and I do that as well.
Randall Kennedy is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a professor at Harvard Law School, the author of a new book of essays called Say It Loud on Race, Law, History, and Culture. If you'd like to join the conversation, you are welcome to join us by phone at 800-838-3760, 800-838-3760. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Randall Kennedy, what do you think Derek Bell might make of this moment where so many people are calling so many different things critical race theory in an effort to ban them, basically?
Yeah, I think that Derek Bell would actually say, told you so. That's what Derek Bell would say, and, you know, he would have a point. So, for instance, for the rise of Donald Trump, Derek Bell would say, told you so. This effort to censor, this effort to suppress critical race theory, Derek Bell would say, told you so. And he would have a point. Actually, in his writing, he was prescient in various ways. He would have a right to say, "Told you so." So you know, that's why I think I doff my hat to certain aspects of Derek Bell's work.
The third essay in the book is very contemporary. It's about the George Floyd moment in history, where you see promise and peril there. You spend some time, interestingly enough and contemporarily enough, on General Mark Milley in here. Why does he rise to the mention?
Yes. General Mark Milley, last summer, gave a speech that, as far as I'm concerned, did not get the attention that it deserved. He gave a speech in which he talked about racism in the military and talked about the need to confront it, the need to recognize it, the need to confront it, the need to overcome it. And he gave this speech right around the time that the then president had that photo opportunity in Washington, D.C. in front of the church. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Milley, did something rather remarkable. He distanced himself from the president, and he gave a speech in which he talked very candidly about the problem of racism in the military, and he spoke very straightforwardly about his disapproval of racism, his abhorrence of racism, and his desire to overcome it. And I salute the general for what he said and for what he did.
To the protests in the street and all the people who came out who might never have marched for anything else before, you do urge care in deciphering the complexities of public opinion in our country. But did you think that what happened in the wake of George Floyd's murder was generally positive in that so many people protested it?
I thought there was much that was positive. I thought it was truly uplifting that across the United States, people of varying ages, varying complexions, varying ideological positions went into the streets during a pandemic to show their disapproval of police brutality. And I took solace from that, and I thought I applaud that. Now, again, you know, things are complicated. Was I critical of certain things? Yeah, I was critical of certain things. I certainly was critical of people who use this, exploited the situation to commit arson, exploited the situation to loot. I thought that that was bad and that that ought to be vocally repudiated, but it seems to me that the overall spirit of the protest that took place in the aftermath of the Floyd murder was good and deserved applause, and I champion the people who came out and indicated to the world that they were upset and that they wanted change. The change was needed. Their view, change was needed. They were right. Change is needed. And by the way, it's still needed. The fact of the matter is that the legal system, it's scandalous that the legal system does such a poor job of regulating the police. The police have a difficult job. The police have an essential job. We need good policing, but the legal system does not do a good job regulating the police. And we need to stay on that issue.
I guess we'll go back to critical race theory and take this call from Aaron in McKinleyville, California. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi. Okay. So thank you for coming on today to, talk about your book. I was just listening and I was hearing about different versions of critical race theory, and I'm sure there are many out there. I wanted to point out something slightly different. I'm assuming that if I walked into Professor Kennedy's class and sat down, I would learn things that were invaluable in this area. On the other hand, the loudest spectrum of our population right now are on the left and on the right identity politics. And they are, quite frankly, feckless, meaning they're low character, not as in a moral low character, but as in a they don't have patience. They don't. When I say character, I'm not talking about morals or ethics. I'm talking about carrying capacity. And so what I'm pointing to is whatever the most useful, valuable version of critical race theory that the professor might be teaching or other professors might be teaching, then there's also this whole grievance studies track that's gone on. And on both sides, the population is populist in the worst possible way, which is to say, a la Robespierre, a la McCarthyism, a la witch hunting. And so if there's many versions of critical race theory, there's also the interpretation in support of everything is power, which is, you know, a cultural Marxist doctrine. And, you know, we're tired of being oppressed, so now we want to be the oppressors. So whatever the professor may be teaching and how valuable that might be doesn't necessarily translate when you get out to the level of students who, quite frankly, didn't have adults, most of them, as parents, so they couldn't model adult behavior. They don't take responsibility for their own emotional reactivity, their own dukkha, to use the Buddhist terms.
Aaron, let me let Randall Kennedy get a chance to speak in here, because this is going on a bit. So first of all, Randall, do you teach critical race theory yourself?
Well, I mean, I write about it and talk about it. I do not call myself a critical race theorist. Your question was, you know, your caller was correct. There are various, you know, you could write a book about what does it mean. The people who are attacking it have given it a meaning. They've made it look stupid. They've made it look totally unattractive. They've made it seem as though people who call themselves critical race theorists don't have anything valuable to say. I think that's wrong. I think they've basically created a boogeyman that they then attack. I think that's what's going on with the effort to suppress critical race theory. Then there are the people who call themselves critical race theorists. Again, you know, and they vary. Some of them basically say two things. I'd say at the heart of critical race theory are two propositions that, as far as I'm concerned, are, you know, thoroughly sensible. One is that race and racism has been deeply embedded in all of American political culture. Well, you know, who can deny that? That seems to me absolutely true. A second thing that they say is that the reforms of the Second Reconstruction, you know, you mentioned before, the 1964 Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, the case law that arose, Brown versus Board of Education, Loving versus Virginia, the critical race theory people say, well, all that was good, but it was insufficient. It was inadequate to deal with the legacy of racial oppression in the United States and new sorts of racial discrimination. And again, I think that they have a point. I would agree with that. Trouble is that some of the critical race theory people then go on to make extravagant claims that I think are invalid, in my view. So one is this notion that there has been no change. Well, what do you mean there's been no change? I mean, you have people at, you know, the leading universities in the United States saying there's been no change. Well, excuse me, you know, people like you wouldn't have been at these universities 30, 40, well, I guess we have to go back 50 years ago. There has been change. That's why you're, you know, in an elite university, because change has occurred and opened up possibilities for people like some of the people who are saying there's been no change. Another thing that I think is a real problem with some of the people who call themselves critical race theorists is they're not attentive Some of them are even hostile to civil liberties. So you have some people who call themselves critical race theorists who are in favor of suppressing what they view as, racist expression. I think that's a terrible mistake. Critical race theory itself is being repressed in the name of attacking what some people view as racist expression. I think that we ought to hold on to our hard-earned civil liberties, our hard-earned conception of civil liberties. And on that front, I'm in strong disagreement with some people who call themselves critical race theorists. But it's critical race theory now in our culture stands for a lot of different things, and so people need to have their antenna up when they hear that term being used and demand, what do you mean when you say critical race theory?
All right, so asking the question and going a little further than just CRT, which has become the shorthand for it. What about Aaron's comment that we're doing identity politics left and right?
Well, I think it's correct. I think that he's correct, and in fact, I think that there's almost a mimicking of thinking. You know, they come out in different, they reach different destinations, but I think that the thinking itself and the sentiments, the absence of nuance, the absence of an ability to recognize that your ideological adversary may have a point. I think that's abroad, and that's evident on the left sometimes, and it's evident on the right a lot of the time. So I think he had a good point.
I want to come to the seventh of the essays, Memorialization, Race and the Politics of Memorialization. And it gets into the issues of things like having buildings and programs named for the likes of Woodrow Wilson, who was clearly working against rights for people of color during his administration. George Washington owned slaves and more. And it sounds like you'd prefer to broaden the conversation a bit from just individuals.
Well, on that one, I'd say a couple things. Number one, symbols are important. They're not, it's not a little thing. Symbols are tremendously important. People have been willing to die for symbolism. So I don't think symbolism's unimportant. Symbolism's very important. I think that we have to be careful when we deal with symbols. Symbols can be, it's not like there's a symbol and it has to have just one meaning. We can give symbols different meanings. And that's why in my essay, I take the position that, well, I understand what the people who want to tear down some of these symbols, and want to remove the statues, want to take names off of buildings. I understand that, and, in principle, I'm not against them. On the other hand, I'm also not against people who would say, I'm willing to live with keeping a name on a building, even though it's the name of a person who was racist, even if it was the name of a person who was a slaveholder, on the grounds that, well, this is part of our history too. And mightn't we want to keep that name on the building to let everybody know about, this person? Yep, this person was an important person in our history. By the way, he did some terrible things. That's part of our history, too. And we want to educate people. We want to educate people to the good that this person did, but we also want to educate people to the bad, about the bad that this person did. So on the question of, the fight over symbols, I'm willing to go with various with various conclusions, actually. I think various conclusions are perfectly reasonable. I don't think that one conclusion, is all good, another conclusion is all bad. I'm willing to live with a wide variety of conclusions so long as we are candid, so long as we are open, so long as we're willing to put the full story of American history out there.
It's an interesting point because I know that I would not have probably known the name of James K. Vardaman, a very racist mm-hmm. governor of Mississippi, if there hadn't been a move to change the name of a building named for him at the University of Mississippi campus. So, you do get to learn even some of the horrible things in our history just from this kind of memorialization that we're now trying to undo in a lot of cases.
I think that's very important. At my school, at Harvard Law School, there was a controversy over the Harvard Law School insignia because the insignia was the insignia of the royal family. They gave the money that actually laid the foundation for Harvard Law School, and they were a slave-holding, slave-trading family. And the question was, what should be done with the insignia? Well, Harvard Law School has gotten rid of the insignia, but formed a committee to, give advice to the governors of Harvard Law School, of Harvard University. One person who was on that committee, Annette Gordon Reed, very distinguished historian and law professor, she dissented. She said, "I want to keep the insignia." And she wanted to keep the insignia in honor of the enslaved. She said, "I don't want the insignia to be lost to history, lost to our eyes. Once we get rid of the insignia, we may very well forget about the enslaved." So she wanted to keep the insignia. That's what I mean. The insignia could mean various things. So, I think we should be careful in our handling of this problem of memorialization.
A couple of emails here. Jeff in Ashland writes, "It seems more evident than ever that the powers that believe in white supremacy have gotten more openly brazen and successful in both policy and public perception in the last 10 years. It has simply become a position rather than the systemic racist bigotry it represents." Thank you, Jeff. Peace in No Town Given writes, "At the heart of all our relations is confirmation bias, a completely natural phenomenon to which all living things are vulnerable. We see what we want to see and hear what we want to hear based on our past experiences. It is vital to all living things to survive. So too is the need to rationalize beyond the intuitive. The chicken that can escape the pen, the rat that avoids the trap, the fish that won't take the bait. Humans must be able to see the bigger picture and realize their gut instincts are at best only 80% right. That leaves a 20% error rate. 20% failure, 20% lethality is simply not acceptable. We have to do better." That from Peace. Final thoughts in our last minute here, Randall Kennedy?
Well, first, I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation, and second, this is a big subject that's not going away, and I hope that people will support forums like this one, in which people can, say what's on their mind, and we can have a disciplined discussion about complex, volatile subjects. So thank you very much for having me on.
Oh, it's absolutely a pleasure. The book is called Say It Loud on Race, Law, History, and Culture by Randall Kennedy at Harvard Law School. Professor, thanks so much.
Thank you. Be well.
All right, take care.